This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Britain's most prestigious literary award, the Man Booker Prize for Fiction, was given last month to my guest Karen Desai for her novel The Inheritance of Loss. At the age of 35, she's the youngest woman ever to receive the prize. Her mother, the writer Anita Desai, was shortlisted for the prize 3 times. This is the first time a mother and daughter were shortlisted for the Booker. Anita Desai will join our conversation a little later. Kiran was born in India in 1971 and was educated in India, England, and the U.S. She now lives in Brooklyn. Her novel is about the legacy of colonialism and what she describes as the enormous anxiety of being a foreigner. The story alternates between a judge in a small westernized town in the Himalayas during a Nepalese insurgency and Manhattan, where Biju, the son of the judge's cook, is trying to make a living working in restaurant kitchens that employ illegal and semi-legal new immigrants. Let's start with a short reading from The Inheritance of Loss. I'll let Karen Desai set it up.
When I first came to New York, what really struck me was how the Third World was meeting for the first time in the basement kitchens of New York. You met someone from Malaysia, who was meeting someone from Tanzania, who was meeting someone from say Saudi Arabia. So this passage has a Biju from India and his friend Said from Zanzibar working together at the Queen of Tarts bakery. Biju and Said find common ground in the fact that they're being sent, hundreds of letters from their families asking for help, and many letters from people who also wish to come to the States, and they feel they're drowning in all these requests. They themselves haven't made it, and yet they're being asked to help others. "I know, man. I know how you feel," Said said. Said's mother was dispensing his phone number and address freely to half of Stone Town. They arrived at the airport with $1 in their pocket and his phone number, seeking admittance to an apartment that was bursting with men already, every scrap rented out. Rashid, Emma, Jafar, Abdullah, Hassan, Musa, Lutfi, Ali, and a whole lot of others sharing beds and shifts. "More tribes," said Said, "more tribes. I wake up, go to the window, and there, more tribes. Every time I look, another tribe. Everybody saying, 'Oh, no visas anymore. They're getting very strict. It is so hard.' And in the meantime, everybody who apply, everybody is getting a visa. Why they do this to me? Those boys, let them in. They will never leave. They're desperate, desperate. Once you let them in, once you hear their story, you can't say no. You know their auntie, you know their cousin. You have to help the whole family. And once they begin, they will take everything. But then everyone have nothing, man. That is why I leave Zanzibar."
Thank you for reading that. That's Karen Desai reading from her novel, The Inheritance of Loss. And this is the novel that won this year's Booker Prize, which is the UK's biggest literary award. This is not a novel about how wonderful multiculturalism is. It's really about how difficult multiculturalism is, particularly for newly arriving immigrants. What made you want to write this book?
Well, there certainly is a richness to the, these multicultural cities of the West. There's a lot of humor, a lot of richness. And I think for one class, the world is becoming flat. The playing field is becoming level. But for another class, I think the story is completely different, and the world is still round. And, you see this very, very successful class in New York of immigrants that's being made so much of, and a shadow class of illegal immigrants where the story is completely different. You see people making epic journeys, journeys that are quite similar to the ones people made many generations ago. And they think, poverty is still intact in much of the world. And we see this in the rest of the world, and we also see this in the cities of the West.
Now, is this a part of the immigrant experience that you're familiar with? You came to the United States as a middle-class person from India.
Well, you know, it's quite true. I definitely am part of the winning class, and a lot of this book is sort of holding up a mirror to people like myself. And myself, I grew up as a very westernized Indian. The family relationship with the West has gone back several generations. And we've been part of the winning class since the days of the British. But on the other hand, I think stories of poverty are extremely close to you in India. You know, you grow up with cooks, people who clean in the house, even if you're a middle-class person. And I think even if you're, you know, in a low-middle-class family, there's still people poorer who will work for you. And there's a complicated hierarchy about who's lowest in the rung and, you know, which part of the country they come from, or even some of them come from overseas, from Nepal or Bangladesh. And you hear these incredible stories of poverty, and they're actually as close to you as anything in your own family. And sometimes these people are closer to you than people in your own family. They know you more intimately. So a lot of these, I don't think it's fair to write an immigrant story leaving out these other stories that are so easily available.
To write your novel, did you have to ask yourself how you look to the immigrants in, say, New York who are having trouble getting green cards and who are at the very kind of bottom of the ladder?
Yes, I mean, I think actually one thing we all share is the horror of the green card. And it certainly was easier for me, I mean, there's no doubt about it, but that horror of the visa and the green card extends, you know, no matter which class you come from. I think there should be a special word in the dictionary to describe green card terror of the, you know, all those emotions that surround the desire for a green card, because it's just so much part of the city. It's on every little street corner, I think, it's sort of what hangs in the air.
A lot of your book is about that desire. So would you describe that desire?
You know, I think, you always are told that immigration is a sort of, you know, heroic story of an individual taking their destiny in their hands and moving overseas and making it in a country that allows you to make it, that just has more room. And yet I think it is more complicated in that we're all brought up to leave. There's such a push out of the country. The most common experience is to line up for a visa outside the British embassy or the American. And that's also something that extends outside the class. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, you are going to line up at that same embassy and try to get abroad. And then I think when you arrive, you just know it's so deep inside you. The next thing you do is to try and get a green card. And this is, of course, what they dread in the embassies. They're all trying to, sift the people out, the ones who will perhaps return, the ones who are going to stay. And they always ask you, are you going to stay? And you always have to say, oh, no, I'm going to come home. Whereas, of course, you are planning to stay. And everybody knows this. So as soon as you arrive, I think the whole thing starts off again. How to get a green card, how to apply, which lawyer is good. People call up the immigration hotline. They watch shows on Indian TV for immigrant lawyers. And it's an endless journey and a huge worry for everybody.
What did you have to do to get a green card?
It took me forever. I think I've been in this country 20 years and I've had a green card for just over 5.
Wow.
And I had to go to all kinds of lawyers and, constant sort of worry, I think, is the main thing you have. And I was on student visas for a long time. And finally applied under a special category for writers and artists and got it through that.
Yes, well, I was wondering, as a writer, is it hard to get a green card? Because it's not like you're going to have a 9-to-5 job.
You don't have an employee, yeah, I know. Uh-huh. So it's a terribly risky field. And for a while, I thought, yes, I should definitely be doing something else. Writing is the worst way. It was absolutely crazy to try and do it in this fashion.
You know, in the reading that you just did, the two characters were feeling very put upon by all the relatives from their countries who wanted to come to the United States and wanted help. Wanted these two guys to help them, even though these guys hadn't made it themselves and had nothing to give. Has there been a network, a family for you coming over that you've helped?
We all came separately. I mean, I have a lot of family here. But no, I mean, again, I'm from a sort of, you know, I'm sort of come from a middle-class background. And all we cope with our visits, and that goes both ways. In the summers, Indian relatives visit us. There's a huge migration of Indian relatives, and all the Indians I know in America expect their family to come for a few months, you know, and everyone says, oh, they don't know how to cook, and they make all these demands, and it's so difficult. They have no understanding that things are different in this country. And meanwhile, all of us go back in the winters to India. And in India, I remember from growing up, everyone says, oh, no, the American relatives are coming, full of complaints, saying the same lines over and over. India is so dirty, it'll never change. They have to be given cereal. Their stomachs are always a mess. So that's really what I mainly deal with. But I think for, you know, people who come from poorer backgrounds, there's this huge feeling of guilt and of having to help a lot of people. And again, I think you can only make it as a successful immigrant if, you know, you go a lot of the distance alone. So you have huge instances of guilt, of cruelty, and also, of course, the other story, and people who make remarkable efforts for their family that's left, you know, family left behind.
You know, one of your characters wonders about one of the people he works with, another kind of like semi-legal immigrant who's working in one of the restaurant kitchens. He wonders why this guy, if he hates America so much, why does he want to stay here? Why does he even want a green card? Is that a question you had to try to answer for yourself about people who seem to dislike the country yet really want to be here?
Mm-hmm. I've seen it so much. I've seen people incredibly angry at this country. And there's no doubt, you know, they will stay. And there's just every effort made to stay. And I think, you know, we're dealing with a world that has such a huge imbalance in power. I mean, that's really where it comes from. I don't think it's really surprising. You know, there are plenty of people who come here and feel of huge amounts of shame, thinking that they've come from the wrong side of the world, a place that doesn't have a voice, and, you know, in the halls of power. And you see a huge amount of anger bursting out, and yet a determination to try and join the game at the top. You know, there's a feeling that this is where you have to be. This is the center of it all. This is where you have to be successful in the world. So I think that's a hard thing for a country that's accepting immigrants to realize, but you see it in so many European countries as well. People don't understand this immigrant anger, and yet it's obviously so huge.
One of your characters, you know, who's been both in England and in the United States, an immigrant who's been in both of those places, says, well, at least in America, people are hypocritical and they try to act nice even if they don't like you, whereas in England, they'll just yell at you, go home.
Well, yeah. No, I'm often sitting in conversations with immigrants from all over, and one of the most hilarious conversations, and I think one that's repeated, is who was worse and which ruler was worse? And people who have been ruled by the British say, oh, the British were actually much better. It's the Portuguese who are really bad, and the Spanish were really awful, and the Dutch, oh no, the Dutch were really cruel. So you have all of these conversations, you know, who's the better master? When I'm in, even when I go back to India, you see, you know, people who, you know, one child has immigrated to Australia, one child has immigrated to Britain, another one to the States. And they sit there and people sit there and discuss this. Where do you assimilate better? Where does it not matter where you're from? Where's history's burden greatest? And of course, that happens to be England.
Do you think that's England?
Well, I think you're just so conscious of the history of colonialism that there's no escaping it. Whereas in the States, it's a fresh relationship and a new one. And I think it's certainly one that's, really optimistic. People seem to be so happy about it on both sides. Bush was treated like a hero when he went to India. And I think even he was surprised at the warmth of that welcome.
Well, you know, you've lived in England and in the United States. So do you get a sense of the people in England relating to you as a former colonial subject?
You know, I think it's just so complicated. In one way, they greet you in the nicest way possible because they know the most about the country. So you can really feel as if you're among people who sort of understand. And of course, there's still people who are real Indophiles and, you know, go back to India all the time. And Indian literature has a very old history of, in England, and people have been reading Indian writers for a long time. Whereas I think here it's a new thing. It's a new phenomenon. On the other hand, I think you're just obviously much more self-conscious. You sort of realize that this has been, you know, this is an old history. People tend to behave in sort of stereotypical ways. And I immediately felt very self-conscious when I was in England. And that sort of dissipated in the States, and especially in New York, where I think, you know, you really feel comfortable walking down the streets no matter where you're from.
My guest is Kiran Desai, and her novel, The Inheritance of Loss, won this year's Booker Prize, which is the UK's biggest literary award. Now, part of your novel is set in the United States. Part of it is set in India. And the one of the main characters in the Indian part of the story is a judge who is the father of the character who works in the kitchens of restaurants in New York. And he also has a granddaughter who is basically deposited at his doorstep by the child's parents, who then kind of leave the country and never come back. Now, I understand that the judge is based on your grandfather?
Well, not exactly, in that my grandfather never had the personality of this judge. So there's a huge, big difference over there. He wasn't an ogre the judge in my book.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing. Yes, we all came out, all right. but I did, and this is certainly a generation where I saw a huge amount of cruelty taking place and a lot of people coming back from England. I mean, it's also been written about quite a bit. In accounts of old people who worked for the Indian civil service. And, even of more famous people like Gandhi and Nehru, are founding fathers. And they came back from England and found they couldn't relate to their families. The families had remained Indian and their wives had remained Indian. And so often I think these women were just put away in the back room. So I did want to write about just what it meant to introduce a Western element into a country that's not of the West. I mean, what does that do to a family? But it is true that my grandfather made this huge journey from a village in Gujarat where he learned the English dictionary by sitting under a street lamp, and then went all the way to Cambridge, took the Indian Civil Service exam, and returned a judge under the British administration, just at the moment the Indian independence movement was going on and people were being called upon to leave their jobs with the British administration. So I began to wonder what it meant to be the sort of hero and traitor rolled into one, and how on earth someone could cope with it. I mean, intellectually, but also emotionally, how would you get around that? And a lot of that generation was very silent about what had happened, and I think a lot of them made up stories that they could live with. But it must have been a really difficult time where they must not have seemed a right way to move. They had made this journey, they were trying to help their families lift themselves out of poverty, attain a different class that wouldn't have been so easy to do in an Indian setting where, you know, class is very strict and caste is very strict. And it was actually the British administration that allowed a movement out of that and a whole different idea of secular India. Of course, good things are always mixed up with bad, and you have to negotiate that.
So what did your grandfather do to earn his living after India became independent from England? Did he remain a judge?
He remained a judge, and, there was such a gap in such a vacuum of power. Everyone had left, that any Indian who was qualified was really promoted and did very well. So he became a judge, a high court judge.
One of your characters, as we've mentioned, works in restaurant kitchens, and sometimes lives in the kitchen. Because it's cheaper than actually renting a place.
Yes, I've been to some basement.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, would you describe what you've seen?
But a lot of this is taken from stories of people on both sides. I mean, people in India have sent their children abroad, and from all the stories you hear in New York, people who worked in the bakery where just next to where I used to live. But I remember going into some of these kitchens of Indian restaurants and just seeing, you know, pots and pans and the cooking going on, and also laundry hanging overhead and towels and vegetables being washed, and also soap and razors on the sink. And you realize that, you know, it's all, yes, it's a scene where people are still living and working and, you know, and sometimes all these kitchens are even connected. I think the family owns a whole lot of them. So there's a big domestic scene going on downstairs.
How did you get access to go downstairs and see what it looked like?
I think people are very friendly when you, you know, when you're talking to people from the same country and you're really chatting about things. And I think people, Indians like to talk.
Did you
We do. We tell each other. We tell each other everything. So, you know, you do get a lot of, you do get a lot of information. I didn't find people being secretive at all.
So, I mean, so how do you get to ask to see the kitchen where people are living as well as cooking? You know,
Just talking to the waiters and saying, oh, where do you live? And then they say, oh, we live right here. And, you know, going down to see.
Right, right.
Just as simple, just very, very, very simple.
Did you feel any different about the food, knowing that there were, you know, razors and towels and laundry next to the vegetables?
Oh, I knew the food would be better. This is where taste comes from.
How old were you when you went to England and to the United States?
I was, I think I was 15 when I was in England and 16 when I was in the States. So high school for me was India, England, and the States, sort of three countries.
In the years that you've lived in the United States, do you feel like you found the Indian American community change a lot?
I have so much. And 20 years ago, I think it wasn't apparent to me. It didn't seem to be a big community at all. I lived first in Amherst in Massachusetts and then went to college in Bennington in Vermont. And of course, there were very few Indians around. And then I think something just very, you know, just the most obvious, simple thing happened. They opened up the quotas, the visa quotas, and a lot of Indian professionals began to arrive. And I think really transformed the cities. And New York, even when I first came, the Indian community was certainly strong, but not this strong. This, the way, you know, I look around now and there's so many South Asian literary festivals and South Asian film clubs and lecture series and, you know, book readings, panel discussions. The restaurants are getting more and more, you know, but the cuisine is becoming more and more specialized. And so it's certainly easier for me to maintain a connection with India now than it was 20 years ago. It's so funny, but I feel closer to India now than I did a little while ago.
You know, just curious, this may seem like an odd question, but since your novel is so much about immigration in a global era, what's your reaction when you call an 800 number, you know, like to buy airline tickets or anything like that? And you know that the person answering your call is actually in India.
I know. And they know you're an Indian in America as soon as you pick up the phone. And I've had some of the funniest conversations, you know, and some really hilarious experiences where they've called me over and over again, you know, same satellite TV company. And first time they say, yes, I don't have a television. And they say, oh, so sorry, madam, not everyone has a TV. And then they call again. And then they call again. And finally I say, stop calling me. You call me every day. They say, oh, Kiran, why are you getting upset, Kiran? You're from India, aren't you? And I say, yes, I am from India. Say, will you be comfortable speaking in Hindi, Kiran? I say, I just don't want to talk about satellite TV. Oh, Kiran, what are you cooking today, Kiran? And then, you know, I began to think this is sort of a complete, somebody should make a Bollywood film. This is a perfect setting, grumpy Indian westernized girl working in New York, sitting alone over her books, call center boys from Bombay calling or from Delhi, gradually. Indians from both countries joining hands, singing songs. I mean, it would be a very funny, it would be a very funny movie, I think.
Joining hands and making purchases.
Making purchases. Dancing across the Brooklyn Bridge eventually.
Well, Kiran Desai, We actually have your mother on the phone.
Oh, how nice.
Your mother, Anita Desai, is, of course, also a writer. And I should explain to our listeners that Karen Desai's new novel, The Inheritance of Loss, won the Booker Prize this year, which is the top literary prize in the UK. And her mother, Anita Desai, was nominated, well, was shortlisted for that prize three times. And this is the only time that a mother and daughter were ever shortlisted for this prize, and certainly the only time that a mother was shortlisted and a daughter actually won it. I think we have your mother on the phone. Hello? Hello?
Hello.
Hi, is this...
Hello, Ma.
How funny this is.
Anita Desai, thank you for joining our conversation. And, you know, we've been talking about Karen's novel. How did you find out that she won the Booker Prize?
Well, I was in India at the time. I was staying with my brother in Dehradun, in the Dune Valley. And we got up at 5 in the morning and turned on the computer and saw her name scrolling across the screen. That was wonderful. And at 6 o'clock, all the TV channels started broadcasting the news. So we knew it was true. It really had happened.
Now, it took Karen 8 years to write this book. And I was wondering if you were ever worried about her.
Embarrassing fact.
Well, Anita Desai, were you ever worried that your daughter would never be able to actually finish this book? Or worse yet, say she finished it and it wasn't published after all that work?
I was certainly not worried about her not finishing it. I was quite sure she would. She was so deeply absorbed in it. I knew she couldn't let it go. I was frightened all the time, I have to say. Seeing her put in so much labor and so much thought, I would have been terribly unhappy if it hadn't received the wonderful reception it did.
Well, Karen Desai, what was it like for you to spend 8 years on one book?
Well, I know it does seem it's completely, I'm embarrassed to say it's been that long. But, you know, after I think a year goes by or 2 years go by, 3 years go by, you just fall into a different way of living altogether. My existence was just not separate from writing this book. And at various times I realized that that was unhealthy and that it was quite dangerous to live like this. And you realize the doors open as a writer and you can exit. Nothing really holds you back. So yes, the book just spilled out into my life and I didn't notice the years passing.
I understand that the original manuscript was thousands of pages. Anita Desai, did you read all those thousands of pages?
No. They weren't thousands, for one thing. There were a few hundred.
Oh, okay.
I think I read what was the first draft. I'm not sure if that's what the draft that Karen kept everything in.
You got a bit of an edited version.
I see.
Did you give your daughter advice on how to shorten it?
No, I didn't think it needed to be shortened. I did sit down with her and go over some of the points I thought of while reading. Just suggestions, really, and pointing out where I went astray or got lost. But other than that, certainly not. And I never asked her to shorten it. In fact, I was sorry that she did shorten it so much.
Karen, what's the best advice your mother ever gave you about writing? Or maybe she doesn't, like, give you advice per se?
She's always very gentle with her advice. It's never a stick held over my head, so I don't even feel it as if it is advice. She didn't advise me to shorten it, and I think that's because that's the kind of reader she is. She's quite happy with a messy book that's also flawed, and that might be better for being longer, messier, harder to read, even though it's not polished. And I think the publishing world expects it to be, you know, they want you to produce a more polished product. And yet I think sometimes when you do that, you lose, a wilder, more eccentric, more difficult quality that also has its purpose. And I sometimes like reading books that are, you know, obviously not perfect.
Well, Anita Desai, do you think your daughter's book lost something by becoming more polished and better edited?
Well, the first draft that I read was so dense and it was so rich. And I was sorry that she let go of some of the characters and some of their histories. I know that editors might have thought of these as digressions. I didn't think of them as digressions. I thought they just made the work so much richer. They were part of its wonderful quality.
Kiran Desai, do you think you were influenced as a writer by having a mother who wrote?
Certainly, but you know, it's so much so that I can't even name the beginning or the end of it. I don't know if it's her her influence as a person or if it's the influence of her books. It's probably a combination of the two. But the biggest thing for me has just been, you know, not having to fight to create an atmosphere in which I could write. I found that I just knew how to live a writing life from her. And when we do write in the same house, I always think about how hard it is for so many writers to create that atmosphere in which they can work. And for me, it's always been available.
Well, Anita Desai, you know, your daughter's saying that she grew up knowing what it's like to be a writer and having you as a role model. You didn't have that kind of role model when you were becoming a writer, and you also had four children to take care of. So it must have been much more difficult for you to carve a place in your life where you were free to write.
Well, perhaps it was difficult to carve a place in which I could write, but it was also absolutely essential. I knew I had to do it. And when the children were small, I used to rush to my desk as soon as they went to school or went out into the garden to play. And there was always that space in my mind in which I let myself live with my book. I couldn't have done without that. Certainly, when I was writing, there wasn't another writer in the house. It wasn't a writer's house. And you're right, one does need role models, and I did have one who lived down the road from where I lived as a child. And I got to know her, and it was just wonderful knowing somebody who lived very like me with her family and yet wrote these wonderful books. Her name is Ruth Jawala, and I've always tried to stay very close to her because she's been my model.
She's a screenwriter, too.
Yes, but in those years she was writing her novels and her short stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Anita Desai, since your daughter's novel is about immigration in a lot of ways, you know, immigration during in a global era, I'm wondering what it was like for you when you decided to move to England and then to the United States, taking your daughter with you, knowing that you were bringing her to new countries. Were you concerned about her adjusting or anything?
Well, at that time, I wasn't thinking of the books that I was going to write or she was going to write. It was just the way my life evolved. At a certain stage, I had to leave and I had to come to the West. And
well, why did you have to leave?
Well, the world I was living in was extremely limited, and I felt I was going over and over the same material all the time. It began to seem very confined and very oppressive, and I did long for a wider world, greater experience. And when this was offered to me, first by the University of Cambridge in England and then by various colleges here in the United States, I took those opportunities. I deliberately wanted to change and expand and widen my experience of life. Kiran was a schoolgirl at that time. I couldn't leave her behind. So I took her with me. And yes, it must have been extremely difficult for her as a schoolgirl, a child of 15 and 16, to be thrown into such a very different environment.
Kiran, was it difficult?
In many ways, I think it was, you know, I think it's inevitable, this kind of journey. I'd never left India before, so it was my first realization of what it meant to be Indian and what you know, the place of India was in the world. And of course, at that moment, I think it was all a blur. And I, you know, as it is when you're a teenager, I think you just distance yourself from yourself. But I don't, in retrospect, I don't think you ever can go back to a simpler life or wish that you had chosen a more simple existence. I don't think you ever turn away richness, even if it's difficult.
Anita Desai, when you said that you had to leave India because you felt limited, and I was wondering if you felt limited as a writer or limited as a woman.
I think I felt limited as a woman. As a woman, I had to live a certain kind of life. I was somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, somebody's mother, but I felt I was never myself, not myself, the writer. And in order to gain that independence, I had to also detach myself from the life I had been leading.
And did it work out that way? Did you get the independence and sense of self that you wanted when you left India and went to England?
It did work out that way. As Kiran has just said, once you have stepped out of that confined but very much more orderly and simple life, you can't really go back to it. And I found myself growing increasingly independent, so much so that it was impossible to become dependent again.
Anita Desai, when you first started getting published in Britain and in the United States, there were fewer Indian writers who were published and widely read. And since then, there have been several, you know, pretty well-known Indian writers. The Indian community has grown in the United States. So I'm wondering if you think, Kiran, that you're different, that your experience getting published and Anita, your experience at getting published are really different from each other? In other words, if it's been any more difficult to get published or to find an audience?
Yes, when I started writing, there were very few Indian writers at all known in the West, and very few of us in India, too. We didn't form a community. There was no sense of community. It was an extremely lonely life that one had chosen for oneself. And I do see things have changed tremendously now, both in India and for the Indian community here in the West. And they do have this wonderful sense of an audience, which is wonderful in a way because it validates what you're doing. But I think it may also be a bit frightening to think of so many people watching what you're doing, waiting for you to bring out the book, ready to pounce on it in a way. And in a way, I'm rather happy that I didn't have that when I was doing my early work. And I could just write for myself without any sense of somebody looking over my shoulder, without being aware of an audience at all. It was lonely, but it was also wonderfully free.
Yeah, I think it is much, it's a much cozier world, it's true. You have, I'm sort of in touch with South Asian writers writing in India, in England, in the States. We all meet at conferences. A huge number of them live in Brooklyn. we all drink together. And there is this wonderful sense of a community of authors, just because there's so many more Indian writers writing now. And of people waiting for books to come out and going to readings with, you know, wine and samosas, which again didn't happen even not so long ago. It's quite recent. I think the big challenge is to be able to lose self-consciousness and to write well. I think when you do write for the market or if you write for an audience or for audience approval, it's like writing for writers' groups or writing in a writing workshop. I think you have to be so determined to disappear from the world and push yourself as far as you need to go, which often is a difficult, weird, eccentric, lonely place. And that is where writing comes from.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. And Kiran, congratulations again on winning the Booker Prize.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Kiran Desai's new novel, The Inheritance of Loss, won this year's Man Booker Prize for Fiction. Her mother, Anita Desai, was shortlisted for the prize 3 times.